Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. As part of our focus on solutions, today we will continue the conversation about how we can achieve women's equality. With the modern women's movement in the 70s, it looked like women were on a steady march to equality. Women broke through glass ceilings and reached top levels in government, business, and society. We had women in Congress, the Supreme Court, and even in space with women astronauts. But about 20 years ago, the march to women's equality seemed to stall. Women are still under 20% of the U.S. Congress and have been at that level for about 20 years. Women are still clustered in lower-income jobs. Women still receive less than men in similar jobs at every income level. Although we think of the U.S. as a world leader for women's rights, in fact, a global gender gap report shows the U.S. ranks 20th in the world. One of the biggest challenges for women is balancing taking care of their children and families with working in their paid jobs. Most mothers I know who work other jobs are in a perpetual state of high stress. Other countries deal with this challenge by providing paid family leave, where a worker can continue being paid while they take time to care for a newborn infant or sick family member. But we don't really have paid leave in the U.S. Why not? And why does it matter? And what can we do about it? To help us answer these important questions is our guest, Vicky Chabot, Vice President at the National Partnership for Women and Families, a nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy group in Washington, D.C. that fights for fairness in the workplace, access to quality health care, and policies that help women and men meet the demands of work and family. Ms. Chabot leads the organization's work on paid sick days, paid family and medical leave, expansion and enforcement of the Family and Medical Leave Act, workplace flexibility, fair pay, and pregnancy discrimination. Ms. Chabot serves as a resource on workplace policy issues nationally. Vicky Chabot, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for asking me to be here, Eleanor. It's great to share this time with you.
Yes, I'm so happy you're here, and I'm glad we're meeting on the air and hope to meet you in person someday. But I've been following the work of your organization, the National Partnership for Women and Families, for some time, and I really admire the good work you're doing. Let's start off. Could you tell our listeners, what is paid family leave?
Yes, great question. And we like to talk about paid family and medical leave because we know, actually, under the Family and Medical Leave Act, that more than half of the time when people need to take leave, it's for their own serious health condition. So paid family and medical leave is time for which people have some wage replacement when they have to be out of work to take care of a new child, whether through birth or adoption or foster care, to care for a seriously ill family member, or to deal with their own serious health condition. That's the way that it's defined under the Family and Medical Leave Act, which, as I think you mentioned, is a law that the National Partnership helped to write and then led a nine-year fight to pass. It passed in 1993, and it's been used more than 200 million times since then by women and men across the country who have wanted to celebrate the first weeks of life, caring for a new child, dealing with those sadder times of addressing a family member's illness, or dealing with their own serious health condition. And in fact, the law was expanded in 2008 and 2009 to deal with the medical leave needs of family members of those who serve in the military, to deal with seriously wounded veterans and servicemen and women, and to deal with the qualifying exigencies, some circumstances that people might need leave when somebody is deployed. So it's a basic thing, but so many people don't have it. And it really causes significant economic hardships to families when people are forced to take time from their jobs without paid time off, or to have to show up to work when their mind and their responsibilities really lie elsewhere.
Right. So the basic idea is that someone who's in a paid job might have a personal health issue, or someone in their family has a health issue, or maybe they have a newborn baby. And with paid family leave, then the worker can go deal with the personal family issue and still receive some amount of pay for their work, right?
That's right. And so often today in the United States, whether somebody has access to that paid family leave time or paid medical leave is completely dependent on where they work and what their employer chooses to provide. And for millions of workers across the country, unfortunately, that's nothing. Just 13% of workers have access to paid family leave. Fewer than 40% have access to some paid time off for serious medical conditions through temporary disability insurance that their employer provides. And only about 60% of workers even have access to a single paid sick day. So that's leaving out a lot of workers, and those people tend to be in lower wage jobs, in service industry jobs, in care jobs, jobs where they're caring for children or for elderly people, and they tend to be concentrated in communities of color. So we're really, there's lots and lots of talk about inequality and economic inequality in our society, and lack of access to paid time off is one of the drivers of that inequality and one of the ways in which inequality is manifested.
Yeah, you mentioned that we've got 13% of people in the workforce have access to paid leave. I notice you're saying you have access to it doesn't mean they use it. And I know some of what's been happening in some of the higher paid jobs anyway is that it's often women who are the ones who do the family care. And women are sometimes reluctant to exercise their access to it because they get judged by their coworkers and their bosses as, not being serious about their work and, being on some kind of a mummy track. So even if they do have access to it, they're sometimes unlikely to use it because it has such negative consequences. Is that what you see happening?
Well, I think a lot of things are going on, and we should separate out the kinds of reasons that people need leave. So I think when we look at women who are giving birth, most women take some time in connection with the birth of a child, but for about a quarter of women, they're back at work within 2 weeks, usually because they don't have access to more paid time off, or if they work for a small employer, might not even have access to job-protected unpaid time off. When paid leave is available, women tend to take around, 10 to 12 weeks for the birth of a child if they can. A lot of people take less than that. But actually, the sort of disincentivizing that culture sometimes the impact of culture is around men and men taking leave. So even if they have access to it, they won't take it. But the mommy tracking that you're talking about is a concern, and I think, for both men and women, for new parents and for family caregivers, there is such a culture in this country around putting work first, that and questioning the loyalty and sort of the drive of people who do acknowledge that they have families and family responsibilities that sometimes take them away from work. There's a significant pressure on all workers, really, to minimize the time that they're taking and make sure that their bosses know that work is their first priority.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Family and Medical Leave Act that was went into effect under President Clinton and 1993, and I think a lot of people thought that this issue was taken care of when that was passed. But that law does not provide for any paid leave, right?
That's correct. What the FMLA provides for is unpaid but job-protected leave and the continuation of health insurance and other benefits like that. But it only applies to about 60% of the workforce. So to be eligible for FMLA leave, first you have to work for an employer with 50 or more employees within a 75-mile radius, and you have to have worked for that employer for at least a year and 1,250 hours, or somewhere around 24 and a half hours a week on average for a year before you're eligible. So that leaves out about 40% of the workforce. And for those people, you know, they really are sort of one child or, you know, one ill family member or one serious illness of themselves away from the potential of losing their jobs, not to mention, you know, jeopardizing their financial security.
Yeah, it's interesting you link this into the growing inequality in our society. So I think it's important to know, you know, yes, wages are important. Yes, the, you know, fight for 15, for the minimum wage to be $15 is important. And the gender gap in income is important. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But in addition to the wage issue for inequality is the benefits issue of inequality, which has not really gotten as much attention in the inequality debate. But I think what you're saying here is drawing that link between the lack of this kind of a benefit of a paid family leave or medical leave that tends to the people in the upper echelons may have it or more likely to have it, but people in lower income jobs are less likely to have it.
That's right. I mean, all of these things are linked together. So, you know, when you look at sort of high wage, high-skilled jobs for which, you know, employers really want to recruit and attract the best talent, they pay those people better. They give them better benefits. They give them perks. When you know, so often the sort of human capital value of people in middle and lower-skilled jobs is really pushed to the side, and that's reflected in the kinds of wages and benefits that they have.
Yeah. So this is the upside of it is this is an arena where we can address inequality in the United States. If we can make progress on paid family and medical leave, that's going to go some distance towards closing the gap of the huge inequality we have in our society right now. So it's showing a pathway to progress to move towards greater equality.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the interesting things we've really been sort of taken with lately is the impacts on children. So we've been part of a group promoting a documentary that is airing on PBS stations around the country over the next couple of months, but is also actually right now available for free online called The Raising of America. And that documentary does a really beautiful job linking together the impacts of parental stress and the impact of parental attention on children with children's outcomes later in life. And so when you think about inequality broadly and sort of the perpetuation of inequality, it also ties into how children do later on in terms of behavior and stress levels and cortisol and attention and all of those things. All of these things are interlinked. And so, you know, having a parent who is really stretched has long-term impacts on children. And creating paid family medical leave, making sure that people have access to paid sick days and to more predictable schedules and to things that just make their lives better and more secure also has impacts on the next generation.
Yeah, and just, you know, to speak personally to this issue, I was a working mother. I had a daughter and was working full-time. And the level of stress just trying to deal with discharging your responsibilities well as a worker and rushing to make sure that your child was taken care of, and what if she gets sick and then you're out, and then what happens to your job and your boss. It's just, it's a very high stress zone that a lot of, if not most, of the working mothers in the United States experience. And I had known about it at a policy level because I had worked at policy at the state level for Massachusetts. So I was talking to women who were working in this area and saying how important it was. So I kind of understood it conceptually. But to actually live through it and to feel that stress, it's just, it's not a happy place to be. And I think we need to be doing a lot more to be family friendly in this country, because other countries have addressed this well. And how does the United States compare to other countries in terms of access to paid leave?
Well, it's so you know, interesting that you ask that question, because we so often hear our elected officials and policymakers kind of touting our family values and how family friendly we are. But when you look at our policies, we are far behind the rest of certainly the high wealth countries and really the world overall when it comes to paid family and medical leave. So, for example, in high wealth countries, those that are in the OECD, we are the only one without paid maternity leave. We're one of a handful without paid paternity leave, and we're one of two without paid sick leave. And then, of course, you know, the sort of talking point that gets repeated over and over is that we're one of, you know, two countries studied by the International Labor Organization that doesn't have paid maternity leave, and it's us and Papua New Guinea. So it's not really the company that we want to be in.
One of two out of how many?
It was 185 that they surveyed, and it's us and Papua New Guinea. There are some other chain island nations that don't have paid maternity leave, but they're not in the ILO survey. I think out of 193 countries worldwide, we're one of seven or eight. So we're not in good company here, and it is, you know, past time for us to catch up. There are a lot of good models about how this works in the rest of the world, and a lot of great evidence that shows that when workers have access to paid family leave, mothers do better, children do better. When fathers have access to paid parental leave, women's economic opportunities improve. So there's really no reason that we should be this far behind. And I think one of the welcome signs is the level of attention that this issue is getting. And hopefully that means progress in the you know, not so distant future.
Right. Well, you know, that is the upside of having these other countries do it ahead of us, is that we do have many good models out there. And I was in Iceland 3 weeks ago speaking at an international women's conference and learned that Iceland ranks number one in the world for gender equality. And I was amazed, actually. They have 9 months of paid family leave, and they have three for the mother, three for the father, and three the parents can choose who gets it. They have affordable quality child care. They have about 40% of women in their national parliament and the cabinet, and they even have gender budgeting in the government. I met the woman, that's her job, is to look at the budget with an eye towards how does this affect the genders, and make sure things are fair. So it was just so inspiring to see a country that's actually doing all of this. And do you think it would be helpful for Americans if they knew more about Iceland and the other Nordic countries as models of what's possible?
Well, you know, I think that's sort of the upside and the downside of American exceptionalism. So I think that it astounds regular everyday Americans when they hear how far behind we are and how we are the outlier. I think for policymakers, sometimes the economic, sometimes the international comparisons don't go as far. But it is rather astounding, and, you know, the fact that we are so far out of the range of what people all over the world have, and that, you know, sort of as an accident of the geography of where you happen to be, you could have such different experiences is pretty remarkable, and does really sort of make people stop and think a little bit.
Yeah. So why do you think it is, you know, if so many people need this, we have the models out there to show that it works, we have the evidence that it's better for the mother, for the father, for the children, for the next generation, even for the companies, this is a better thing to do. So why are we so far behind, and what's it going to take to get this passed?
Well, let me take those questions separately. So why are we so far behind? A few things. One, you know, we sort of have this very individualistic mentality here. People should pull themselves up by their bootstraps. It's sort of, you know, family matters are private matters. And we really need to see a shift there, and I think we're starting to, that these actually are not private matters. They're matters of grave social and economic concern. We're leaving our talent on the table and leaving economic productivity and growth on the table by not addressing this issue. Two, we have organized business opposition here that, you know, dating back to child labor laws and Social Security and unemployment, have said that more government regulation creates insurmountable burdens for businesses. And we know time and again that those things aren't true, but the intersection of money and politics and the fear that those arguments are able to inspire is really powerful and is holding us back. And so one of the good points now is that we have evidence from three states that paid family leave works, and we have private sector companies that are stepping up every day to say, we believe this is a win for us. And so I think we're starting to see a chipping away at some of those arguments and some of the power and fear that those arguments have or have on impacting people. And three, we have some questions about people, you know, distrust government and sort of distrust role of government, and we need to get past that and look at the value that programs like Social Security have had in lifting people out of poverty, the Children's Health Insurance Program has had in improving child health, and remind people that, you know, smartly run, efficient, good government programs actually have widespread value for lots and lots of people, both directly and indirectly, in the short term and in the long term. And then finally, I think there's still some ambiguity here among the role of women in the workplace, and this sort of false sense that women can choose not to work. And we know that the economics of that for, you know, the overwhelming majority of families just don't work out. It's, you know, virtually impossible today for, you know, one parent to be a breadwinner and another parent to stay home and be a caregiver. And so we need to restructure the way that our economy and our society operate to recognize that truth. And we need to also recognize the fact that a lot of, you know, the highest share of births now to young women are to single mothers. And so recognizing we need to adapt our social and economic policies to that as well. So that's sort of the why are we here, that how do we change it, I think is up to your listeners. It's up to you and to take action and demand more, you know, in this season where, you know, we're having robust national debates on television, you know, multiple times a month. It's up to regular people to stand up and say, this needs to change. It needs to change for me and my family and for my children and for my aging parents. People need to take action and contact members of Congress, telling them that it is time for paid family and medical leave. And they can do that at our website, nationalpartnership.org/the Family Act. We'll take them straight to a learn more and take action page. And we need to be marshaling the research that's out there. As I said, there's a growing body of evidence from states that have passed paid family leave programs, from companies that offer paid family leave on their own to their workers, to show that this is, you know, good for workers and families, it's good for businesses, and it's good for the economy.
Yeah, that all sounds good. Now, did you work personally on the passage of the Family and Medical Leave Act back in 1993?
I personally did not, but the organization, you know, as we talked about at the beginning, has a long history. And our current senior advisor, former president, Judy Lichtman, who is still very, very much a part of everything we do here every day, was instrumental in the passage of FMLA. And, you know, there have been so many lessons that we've incorporated into our current work from that time, even though that the era is very different.
Yeah, because that was, for its time, very groundbreaking. You know, and with that Family Medical Leave Act, as you mentioned, we can have unpaid leave for now it covers about 60% of workers. So it was a good start, but that was 22 years ago, and it needs to be expanded so it covers all workers. It needs to include pay so that people can keep some money going while they're out. So I'm glad that that your organization got behind that. I'm glad you're still working on it. Do you happen to know when that was passed, what the biggest obstacles were and how they were overcome to get that legislation passed?
I do. I know a little bit about that. So, you know, it's really interesting. If you look at the archival footage of the congressional debate, it's the same arguments we hear today. Businesses can't afford it. The sky will fall. The U.S. economy will tank. That's sort of the one category. Sort of business burden, businesses, you know, can't afford it, losing jobs, et cetera. The other piece is around fraud and abuse. People are going to use this. It's going to be the Friday-Monday Act. And we know that that is absolutely not true. The most recent data from the Department of Labor shows, you know, less than 3% of employers suspect any broader abuse, less than 1% know that there's been a problem. So that has definitely not come to pass. You know, the passage of the Family and Medical Leave Act in 1993 was succeeded by the most prosperous time post-war in terms of economic growth and all of that. So, you know, those arguments have not come to pass. And then, you know, some of that same ambivalence around the role of women in the workplace was also present at that time. And although, you know, I think we've moved a long way, that's still a factor. Some of the other lessons, though, of the FMLA that I think are very instructive. One is around personal stories. The real human toll that's taken when people don't have access to time away from their jobs when a serious family or medical need arises, and the coming together of some unusual allies, often around personal stories, but also around values. So, you know, it's really interesting that the FMLA coalition involved the United Conference of Catholic Bishops, as well as groups like ours that fight for reproductive rights, as well as groups like the AARP and the Junior League. So it really did, it was a very intersectional coalition that worked to pass the law, and that's something that we strive very hard to replicate in our current efforts.
Yeah, those personal stories can be very powerful, so I'm glad you're weaving them into your work. And so we have made some other advances, as in many things, with Congress now being kind of caught in dysfunction and not really doing as much as it needs to be doing in a lot of areas, including this one. But the cities and the states seem to be moving ahead. You mentioned three states that now have the paid family leave. You know, what are those states and how did it get passed there?
Yes, so there are now three states that have paid family leave. So that's, again, partial wage replacement through a public social insurance fund that people can use when they have a new child or a family member who's seriously ill. Those three states are California, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. And they happen to be three of the five states in the U.S. that already had temporary disability insurance programs in place. So in those states, it was relatively easy to create those systems by piggybacking onto these existing temporary disability insurance programs. The passage in both California and Rhode Island was very, very swift. The campaigns there lasted, you know, less than 2 years, and the programs have been overwhelmingly successful, although there are lessons learned in terms of education and outreach, the level of wage replacement that works, and some other things that we can carry into future campaigns. You know, these programs are, all of the research shows that they've had positive impacts for workers, and they've not been burdensome for businesses. So that's a real bright spot in the work that's happened, and also in the research that has been able to follow that work to lead to more progress. New York is one of the other states that has temporary disability insurance. And just today, actually, Valerie Jarrett, who's a very senior advisor to the president, is in New York doing a roundtable on this very issue, hoping to spur more attention and momentum and hopefully make New York the next state to pass paid family leave.
Yeah, well, that's encouraging. So let's hear it for the states. And, you know, we hear that refrain all the time. We hear it on the $15 for minimum wage bill. The companies are saying, well, no, you'll be putting all these companies out of business. But actually, you know, the evidence on that is it's somewhat mixed, and it does increase the cost for businesses, but it does not put lots of businesses out and shut them down. It's actually a good stimulus for the country because workers have more money, they're spending more money, and they become better customers and consumers that actually prop up and make the company, many companies, much more prosperous. So I'm glad to see you getting the research there. Let's go back for a minute to paid sick days.
Yes. And great.
You know, it's kind of an assumed thing. I thought this was something that was kind of settled back in the Depression back in, with FDR and all the great programs put in place then, but did you say that only 60% of workers have access to at least one paid sick day?
That's right. In the private sector, 61% of workers have access to paid sick days, which means that 39% don't. That's close to 44 million people who don't have access to a single paid sick day. And again, we can see stark lines of inequality there. So among high-wage workers, it's like 85%. Among low-wage workers, it's only about 20%.
So that's kind of scary. Someone gets sick, they don't get a paid sick day, they certainly lose the income if they stay home sick, and they may lose their job, right?
That's right, and these are the most economically vulnerable people. So, of course, what choice can they make? But, you know, unless it's just impossible, they are, you know, have no choice but to go to work sick, which has public health consequences for everybody else. But, you know, if you're in the shoes of that person, and the difference between staying home and going to work is whether you can feed your family, or, you know, the difference is between losing your job and working sick, that's not a choice. That's a, you know, a Hobson's choice, to say the least. So [S2] Yeah. [S1] this is a serious economic problem. It's a public health problem. It's a moral problem. And, you know, there, too, the good news is that cities and states are leading the way, and hopefully before long we'll see a national paid sick days law pass.
Yeah. Well, on the paid family leave and the paid medical leave, you know, you were talking about an insurance fund that the government would run, and it, since the federal government's not doing it, it's falling to the states to do, and three states now have it in place. With the paid sick days, that's more of a private employer issue, right?
That's correct. So the way that paid sick days policies work, and there are now laws in place in four states, the District of Columbia, one county, and 18 cities, is that workers earn paid sick time. It accrues, and then when somebody is sick, you just are paid as you normally would be. So the way that the laws work is typically you accrue an hour of paid sick time for somewhere around 30 hours worked up to a maximum number in a year that you can use. And usually that's somewhere between 5 and 9 days, depending on which law we're talking about.
So it is up to the business what to do, but the states can pass laws that really demand that companies provide paid sick time. Is that right?
That's right. And the paid sick time laws have some parameters to them. So it's typically that you earn sick time that you can use to care for yourself, a family member, or in many places, if you're a victim or related to a victim of domestic violence, to take time to address those issues with, you know, legal services or counseling or court or what have you, relocation. But, yeah, I mean, it's pretty astounding that 44 million people in this country risk being fired or losing income if they need to take a day to recover from the flu or wake up with a fever or have a child, you know, that falls off the jungle gym and needs to go to the doctor.
Yeah. Well, what do you say to the businesses who say this is a burden on our business, we're kind of making it through, but we're struggling, and if the government forces us to provide paid sick time to workers, that's going to cut into our profits and we may not make it. So what do you say to them?
I say that the good news is that there's a lot of evidence now that that hasn't happened in the places that have had these laws in place the longest. So if you look at San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Connecticut, Seattle, Jersey City, and now New York City, places where there have been studies, there's absolutely no evidence to show that there's an adverse impact on business growth or job growth, including in the industries that have been most affected, on inflation or prices, on businesses closing or moving across lines. These things that we hear and that the business, that opponents often hold up as reasons to continue with the status quo, none of these things have come to pass. And in fact, in the places where these laws exist, business, more than a majority of businesses, often two-thirds of businesses, are supportive.
Really? They're supported before it passes or after it passes?
No, before. So there haven't been so many polls of businesses before it passes. Often before it passes, what happens is you have a few very vocal businesses that come out and testify against these measures, or in the case of ballot measures, you know, put up ads opposing the proposals. But once they pass, surveys of businesses in San Francisco and in Connecticut, and probably a couple of others show, you know, 60% or more of businesses in support.
Right. So it looks like this is the way it's going to happen now, that we'll get cities and states to make this, you know, say either a city or state law for paid family leave. Well, not paid family, that's, we've got to get the insurance, but for the paid sick time for workers, that we can do on a city and state level more easily, right?
Yeah, because there's no infrastructure. Other than enforcement, which is very important, and publication and public education and outreach, which is very important and is something that's done by government entities or by the agency that enforces the law, the rest of it is a private, it's a transaction, you know, between employers and employees. So it's relatively easy to do at the local level where the law permits that, or at the state level. But ultimately, you know, big companies would much prefer to have a national standard. And so there's going to be a tipping point where, you know, it becomes better to have a national law that still allows these state and local laws that have passed to exist, certainly not to preempt them. That wouldn't be good. But a standard that basically, you know, applies everywhere where there isn't some other law in place.
Yeah, and there are more and more companies who are stepping up and doing the paid sick leave and, to some extent, the paid family leave. But am I right in seeing that we can make significant progress probably pretty rapidly on the paid sick time, which is relatively simple, but that it may take a lot longer to do it, that we can't count on employers to implement the paid leave?
I think that's right. I mean, it's interesting. There have actually been several, many high-profile announcements around parental leave or family leave this year, and just today Spotify announced a new parental leave policy. And so there have been a lot of high-profile announcements there. It's still, you know, the most recent data still shows, as I said before, only 13% of workers have access to paid family leave. So big companies that are well-known can make announcements, but that's not necessarily translating into a huge impact on the population, and certainly not to the parts of the population who are most in need. On paid sick days, there have been a couple of announcements. Chipotle announced paid sick days. But again, there the real progress has been with the state and city laws that have passed. In terms of what we can expect to see going forward, certainly more paid sick days victories. I do think there will be some paid family leave victories in the, you know, relatively near future. So New York, as I said, potentially here in the District of Columbia where I am, possibly in the state of Connecticut where there are active bills, possibly in the state of Massachusetts over the next year or so. But ultimately, it's very costly and fairly inefficient to go state by state for something that is should be a national social insurance program, and also to make sure that people in states that don't have a history of legislating in this area are able to see relief when it comes to paid family and medical leave. So, you know, what we hope is that states lead the way, and ultimately we'll have a national solution on both of these. But in terms of the structure of a program, paid family leave in particular needs to be national.
Yeah. And sometimes it's good to have these companies who do step forward are more enlightened and see how it's really in their own enlightened self-interest to put these policies in place. What are some of the companies that are doing the right thing here?
Well, there have been, several high-profile announcements. This year, as I said, Spotify just announced today. Stonyfield Farm recently announced a new parental leave policy. Adobe actually announced family and medical leave. Hilton Hotels created a paid parental leave policy even for its hourly workers for company-owned hotels, which is pretty unique. Netflix, of course, announced a policy earlier this year that caused a little bit of backlash, but also point out the inequality.
Certain workers would get it and other workers didn't qualify.
Right. But there have been a number of announcements. Microsoft expanded its parental leave policy this year. I'm trying to think of some of the others, but those are the key ones that come to mind. But again, it's a number of them. And what it's doing, you know, is both changing the narrative that these benefits are too costly or too burdensome, and hopefully it will provide us data to show the return on investment that then can be used to help bolster public policy arguments as well.
Yeah, that's great. And it's certainly, for whatever reason, this whole idea of paid sick leave and paid family and medical leave is more in the debate now than I remember it for many years. And why do you think that is?
Well, I think a number of things are happening here. First of all, the changing demographics of the workforce and the changing demographics of the population are making the need for paid leave all the more urgent. So, and that's causing real people to speak out and say, hey, this isn't just my problem. This is a bigger problem. Two, I think, the momentum and the grassroots energy as a result of these state and local campaigns is adding momentum. It's helping policymakers and the public alike and the media, frankly, to see that progress is possible and desirable. It's helping elected officials to see that not only is the policy good policy, but it's good politics. These policies are extremely popular and motivating to people. The evidence from the states and cities, again, is showing that the fears of opponents haven't come true and that these are win-win-win policies for workers and families, businesses, and the economy. And finally, there's more sort of high-level attention to this. So everybody from business professors and academics who have started to lobby Congress on this to late-night comedians like John Oliver, who's pointing out the absurdity, pointed out on Mother's Day the absurdity of the fact that it's us in Papua New Guinea, to, sort of popular news magazines like CBS Sunday Morning that did a big feature on this for Father's Day. So there's just more attention and more reflectiveness to ask why it is that we are doing things this way and what harms the status quo are doing and what could be different and how that would help people.
Right. And I would imagine support for these kind of paid sick leave and paid family and medical leave is probably pretty high among the people. Is that right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Overwhelmingly popular. I think in our 2014 post-election survey, so a very, relatively conservative electorate, I think 81% of voters said that they wanted lawmakers to consider policies like paid family and medical leave, paid sick days and equal pay. Recent polling from Democracy Corps has shown that these issues, more than any other, are motivating to people and getting them engaged in elections and campaigns. And some research that we actually did after the 2014 elections, looking at candidates' websites and doing some analytic work there, showed that, when you hold other factors constant, a candidate who took a position on these issues was more likely to win. So, again, it's that intersection of policy, popularity, and politics that I think is really taking the debate here to a new level. And the fact that men and women, new parents and family caregivers so urgently need these policies really helps to put the human face on it. And then the fact that the businesses are speaking up to say this is good for us too. Some businesses are speaking out to say we should have public policies. So companies like Care.com and Patagonia and Eileen Fisher and a number of others who have endorsed the Family Act, which is the national paid leave bill in Congress. All of these things are really pointing us, I think, towards a place where these issues are on the national debate, are core to not only a progressive policy agenda, but really just a forward-looking economic agenda, makes me very optimistic about where we could end up, a couple of years down the road.
Well, that's very encouraging. And, of course, we have a woman running for president who has this as a big part of her program and speaking eloquently to the issues of women and families. So I think, you know, all of it helps to make this something that's on our radar screen now, which I'm so happy to see. And you mentioned about the broader economic agenda. You work on many issues, including the gender-based wage gap. So can you tell us a little bit, you know, where do we stand now with the gender-based wage gap?
Yeah, I mean, and these issues are all related, of course.
Right.
So, yeah, and, you know, it's not a coincidence that we work on all of these things because economic opportunity is facilitated by many things, and pay discrimination is still a real part of some women's lives. But on the whole, women who work full-time year-round in the U.S. Are paid 79 cents for what to every dollar paid to men who work full-time year-round. For women of color, it's much worse. African-American women who work full-time year-round earn 60 cents on average, and Latino women earn 55 cents on average to what men earn. So we've got a long way to go, and of course those wage gaps, statistics aren't just figures. They translate into reduced purchasing power for women, reduced ability to pay rent or put food on the table, reduced opportunity to save for a comfortable retirement, or the ability to send a child to college. So the wage gap has real financial consequences, not just in terms of fairness, but also in terms of economic security and opportunity.
Right. And I remember years ago the figure of the gender pay gap was 55 cents that women earn for every dollar paid to men. And I at first was encouraged to see we had narrowed some of that gap to 79 cents to every dollar paid to men. And then I learned that some of the reason why the gap closed is not, it is, of course, partly women are earning more, but it's also true that men's economic situation has gone down. And it's a little bit of a mixed good news, bad news statistic that gender gap has closed, and we want to see all wages going up, not just women, but it has to happen for women sooner. And you mentioned before about we have to adjust to the new realities that are happening in our society and our family. You get now 40% of the women are either the primary or the sole breadwinner in the family. So we're not just talking about pin money here. We're talking about real money that women need to earn in order to take care of our families.
That's right. And then if you couple that with the growing number of female-headed households, where they are the sole breadwinner, right, embedded in that 40%. I think, as we've talked about, women are essential to their families as caregivers and as breadwinners. But the breadwinning piece is really important. And although some of the wage gap can be explained by men and women in different jobs or working different hours, the wage gap persists at every education level in virtually every industry and virtually every job, and some portion of it really can't be explained in any other way besides discrimination. So we can fix some of these other things. We can create better leave policies. We can create better pathways to advancement and opportunity. We can encourage women to be in non-traditional jobs and higher wage jobs, but we also need to make sure that women aren't being treated differently than men in terms of what they're paid or when they're offered promotions or raises.
Yes, and it's amazing to me in this day and age that there is still that gender discrimination. Women are still not frequently not given equal pay for comparable work, and it's across every field and it's at every income level. It just astounds me that this is still so. So we have a lot of work to do on that. And just yesterday I participated in a meeting at the U.S. Senate where Senator Elizabeth Warren was there with the Economic Policy Institute, and they released what they call the Women's Economic Agenda. Have you happened to see that yet?
I have, yeah. I took a quick look at it yesterday, and a colleague attended a roundtable afterwards. So, yes, I think it's great that EPI has put out this agenda. The more voices calling for things like a higher minimum wage and closing the pay gap and paid sick days and paid leave, this is all adding to the chorus that's demanding change.
Yeah, and what do you think we need to do to close the gender wage gap and stop the gender discrimination in pay?
Well, I mean, I think it's a range of public and private solutions and some individual solutions, but we put out a paper last year for Equal Pay Day called An Unlevel Playing Field that looked at the gender wage gap for women of color, for mothers, and for mothers of color and single mothers, really digging down into the economic consequences of the wage gap for each of those groups. And then we laid out a blueprint for change that looked at really three parts of how to get women into better jobs or into higher paying jobs, how to make sure they're able to stay in those jobs, and then how to make sure that they're advancing in those jobs without discrimination or hostile work environments or things like that. And so the kinds of solutions that we pointed out were everything from some that we've already talked about here, raising the minimum wage, paid leave, paid sick days, scheduling fairness, better non-discrimination laws around pregnancy to make sure that pregnant women aren't forced off the job or forced to compromise their health when they need accommodations, equal pay laws that promote equal pay and punish pay discrimination, like the Paycheck Fairness Act, programs to help women get into better paying jobs, and, you know, better enforcement of existing non-discrimination, but, you know, also programs that help women negotiate better and smarter, and business initiatives like Salesforce and others have done to make sure that unconscious bias isn't tainting the salaries or opportunities that women are offered.
Yeah, I think that's all good. And I think, you know, part of that we can start with just some sunshine, like making it more known what the wages are. So if a woman's working, she has a right to know if the guy doing the same job or a very similar job, you know, what's he getting paid? Is he getting paid more than her or is it equal? So, you know, sometimes a little sunshine can go a long way.
Right. I mean, one of the craziest things today is that in some companies you can be fired if you ask a colleague about their pay information and what they're being paid, or you can be retaliated against. And so there's a lot of energy out there to change that so that workers couldn't be retaliated against for water cooler conversations, sharing their salary or wage information with their coworkers. And that's different than affirmative disclosure or sunshine. That's like simply your right to talk about your compensation.
Yeah, and you mentioned pregnancy discrimination, you know, and again, you just think, my God, it's 2015. They still have discrimination against women who are pregnant. You know, what's happening with that now?
That's right. So, you know, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which is another law that we were involved in writing and passing back in 1978, that's now been on the books for, you know, well over 35 years. And yet pregnancy discrimination persists. Some, of course, is, you know, garden variety, clearly against the law type of pregnancy discrimination. And we're actually in the process of looking at EEOC filings and charges to see what that looks like. But another piece of it is, again, women who need a lifting restriction or need a water bottle or need a stool to rest on rather than standing up as they're, you know, checking out customers at a grocery store. And although the Pregnancy Discrimination Act has been interpreted in some cases to cover those kinds of situations, employers often aren't providing the kinds of accommodations that they would be providing to other workers and are denying them to pregnant workers. And so a proposal in Congress, which actually has bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate, is called the Pregnant Worker Fairness Act. And it would give women a right to reasonable accommodation on the job to protect their health and the health of their pregnancy.
Yeah, excellent. Well, and I'm hopeful that can be something that actually moves with bipartisan support there in Congress. And we just have 2 minutes left, but before we end, I want you to be able to tell our listeners, what can we all do to help advance the measures that you've talked about today?
Well, it would be great if listeners go to our website, nationalpartnership.org. We have a take action page There are action alerts up there so that you can contact your member of Congress on the Paycheck Fairness Act to combat wage, the gender pay gap and wage discrimination, on the Pregnant Worker Fairness Act to guarantee reasonable accommodations to pregnant women who need them on the job, the Healthy Families Act for paid sick days, and the Family Act, or Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act, to create a national paid leave insurance program. So, you know, we all know that members of Congress are interested in hearing what constituents have to say, and particularly if a number of constituents from a particular place weigh in. So please go to our website, nationalpartnership.org, and take action on those issues. For followers who are on Twitter, you can use our WeTweet tool, WeTweet.org, to tweet directly to your member of Congress just by entering your zip code. And then finally, as people are paying attention to the coming presidential debate, ask questions of the candidates. Tweet them, call their headquarters, tell them that issues related to working women's economic security, women and families, issues like paid leave and paid sick days and pregnancy and equal pay are at the top of your agenda, and that they should be at the top of the agenda of the candidates as well.
That's fantastic. I love all of that, and I know a lot of people feel that Congress is working mostly for the rich people now, but that's no reason to stay away from voting and engaging in a public debate and communicating with your members of Congress and your officials at the state and local level. That's all the more reason we need to be involved and active to kind of counteract that. So, and we can rely on your great advice and your website and your wonderful research. So that's all the time that we have. Vicki Szabo, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work.
Oh, thank you for having me, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.